Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
And thank you all for coming out in the snow and being with us this morning, and also, of course, for listening to us on WWJ News Radio 950. Here we are almost at the end of the year, looking ahead to another year, a brand new year. The economy has been expanding. It's been doing that for over 10 years now. Wow, that's great news. Corporate profits are high. The stock market opens today at record highs. What more can you want? A lot more if you're one of 78 million Americans, because that's how many people are in a financial jam right now across the country. 4 out of 10 Michigan residents can't make ends meet, according to figures compiled by the governor's office. What do you do, and what's your best move for the new year? I'd like you to meet Leon Labreck, who's on the end over there. He's the chief growth officer, Sequoia Financial Group. He has ideas for you. He appears in the media locally and nationally. He's an attorney, a CPA, certified financial planner, certified financial analyst. He has all the credentials that you'll need to know. Charles Hoff, DFCU Financial. He is a financial education counselor. Charles conducts financial seminars. Over 14,000 people have sought his advice. He's been with the company for 30 years. And on her way here right now, making it through the snow from the western part of town, is Sheila Marable. She'll be with us shortly. She's a certified treasury professional, vice president, treasury management officer at PNC Bank. She counsels small businesses on how to prevent fraud. It often spills over into households, and it spills over into families. As we begin a new year, first question to ask her is, what should businesses and anybody who works in a small business or owns a small business or manages a small business be thinking about? What action should they be taking? Because statistics tell us $50 billion is stolen every year from businesses by their employees. A lot of it happens internally. Companies don't even know about it. So we'll talk about that. But Leon, as we look ahead to the new year, what are you thinking? What goes through your mind? What are you doing to prepare for 2020?
Well, Murray, we ought to look at 2020 and say hindsight is 2020. There's a lot of things on our mind. Everybody's asking me about, what do you think about the impeachment hearings? Forget it. No one cared about Mueller. No one cares about the impeachment. Yesterday was the big blockbuster, and the stock market hit an all-time high. So skip that. You want to worry about something? Worry about China. We keep trying to make a deal, and the deal doesn't seem to be going through. We want to start taking a look at some of the other things that are happening. The stock market thinks we're not having a recession. The bond market is convinced we're having a recession. Who's right? So the thing we ought to be all looking at is, we ought to reset. We're going into a new decade. Let's reset the financial plan. Let's reset what we're going to go do. Let's get the long road plan and figure out what we're going forward. So there's going to be a new law probably passing this year that changes everybody's IRA. So I'm looking at tariff, recession, IRAs. Those are my big three. That's where I'm going in 2020.
And Charles, I know one of the first things that you're going to do in the new year is plan your seminar schedule for around February, because you have told me that every year after the holidays, the calls come in with people who realize that they may have overdone it a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we have our debt-free living seminar. We actually have 100. I just finished my calendar, 111 seminars next year planned.
How many?
111.
111 seminars.
Right, right. But, yeah, debt-free living is our, you know, the one we discuss with budgets. Are basically, what people do is they, I call it the American budget. People take their take-home pay, pay their bills, live on what's left. Doesn't work, because what people like to refer to as the unexpected always comes up. That typically goes on credit cards and that, the unexpected expense. And so we talk about how to shift viewpoints, start anticipating these things instead of referring to them as unexpected expense. A lot of times when you consider it an unexpected expense, you're basically telling everybody life is controlling you. You're not in control of life, because you're looking at all these things as unexpected. Car repairs, an unexpected expense. A new roof, an unexpected expense. Our grandparents would never let us get away with that. They'd say, how many years you've been looking at those shingles curling, right? You should be anticipating that expense. And so because we don't anticipate, we don't build that into the budget, this stuff tends to go on credit. And so I tell people, you know, Consolidation loans, home equity loans, bankruptcy do not change spending habits. So they're going to, it's going to create debt. So we talk about how to get out of that hole.
All right. You mentioned unexpected expenses.
Right.
That nothing should really be unexpected because we should be expecting them. For example, how long have you been in your house? How long have you had your kitchen oven? 11 to 15 years. That is the life of a kitchen oven. If it's 9 years old, there's going to be an expected expense that you should have, at least budgeting for right now. Clothes dryers, 10 years. Windows, 26 years. How old is the house? How long have the windows been in there? Brick on the outside of the home, 50 years. You might think, well, I don't have to worry about that kind of stuff. But most homes in the United States are close to 50 years old. Furnaces, 10 to 15 years. Electric or gas water heaters, 10 years. Asphalt, shingle, roof, 20 years. All of these are expenses that you're going to have one way or another, right? So you better expect them and plan for them.
Right. And the other thing, too, is a lot of times people, because they're not building that into the budget, because they have the backstop, which is Visa, MasterCard. You know, when we were kids, we asked mom and dad to help us out, right? Well, that dependency shifts over to Visa, MasterCard. And because we're not anticipating future expenses and building that in a budget, we tend to overbuy houses and cars.
We're going to talk about that a little bit later on.
Sure.
But when we talk about unexpected expenses, we're really talking about stuff that we think is uncertain in the future. And Leon, you have talked so much and you've done so many seminars on uncertainty, reducing uncertainty, and how you do that. What are you talking about when you talk about that?
Well, Murray, you got to think about the fact that we've got things that are risks, and a risk is a known thing. So you know your oven's going to go. That's a risk. You know it's going to happen. An uncertainty is an unknown unknown. So what would be the unknown unknowns? So you might say, okay, what's the unknown unknown if we have a new president? What's the unknown? But that's not an unknown unknown. That's a known risk. The unknown unknown is what happens if you have a catastrophic illness. There's something that comes into play. So the mission of a great financial plan should not be to get rid of risks, but to reduce the uncertainty, to reduce the level of things that take place. So I can assure you that over time, if you have a balanced portfolio, you reduce the uncertainty of the market correcting. I promise you the market will correct. It will go down. I promise you someday we will have a recession. It will happen. When? I have no idea. But on the case that it will happen, knowing it will happen, we reduce the uncertainty by preparing for that. So when I was a Boy Scout back in the 70s, we had a motto, be prepared. And be prepared means how do you set yourself up so that the uncertainty doesn't harm you, or more importantly, doesn't kill you. So what would happen if I told you we knew we were going to have a recession by the end of next year? Well, you'd set up a budget. You'd go look at your cash flow. You'd probably go get a line of credit from the credit union ahead of time. You'd build up some dry powder so you could buy stuff. Everyone in this room should think about the fact that how would you have liked to had $100,000 on March 9th, 2009? March 9th, 2009 was the bottom of the stock market. It was the bottom of the recession. I lived in Hazel Park when I was a kid. You could have bought a block in Hazel Park for $100,000 in 2009. Now you can buy one house in Hazel Park for $125,000. You could have bought one share of Ford Motor Company for $1.74 on March 9th. A can of Diet Coke is $1.75. Citigroup was a buck. So how do you prep yourself for that? It is certain that sometime we're going to have volatility. So prepare for that and reduce your uncertainty. And that's probably the paramount thing of any good financial plan. Lots of us talk about risks. Do we insure the house? Have we insured our portfolio? Have we done other things? The real question you should be asking yourself is, how can I be best prepared for what I don't expect? So that's my take on it.
Does anybody have any questions so far? Any questions for these guys? Okay. Sheila, why don't you come up here? Thank you for being with us. We have already talked about you and your credentials. Why don't you step right up here?
Thank you.
The snow can hold everybody back, and we appreciate that you made it out in the snow to be with us here. Good morning. We're just talking about things that we're looking forward to in the new year and things that we have to look ahead and plan for in the new year. And I was telling everybody that your specialty is really the business sector, and you are the person who is called in when they realize that the money doesn't all add up, when there's
Absolutely.
Some kind of a problem like that. Tell us a little bit about what you do.
So I am a treasury management officer for PNC Bank. My job is to work with customers to help them manage their cash flow more efficiently, help protect against fraud. I'm sorry, I'm out of breath. I was running in here. So help them protect against fraud, help them to use the balances that they have in their account better instead of that money just sitting in your account doing nothing for you. We want it to earn something for you. But that's the main thing that I do. But like Marie said, I get calls every day about fraud and fraud suspects.
And we were talking before that the figure was about $50 billion that businesses are losing every year because employees are taking from them. There's external fraud and internal fraud. If we have people here who work in businesses, manage businesses, own small businesses, we're going to talk about that in the moment ahead. Let me let you catch your breath. And Leon, let me go back to you because you mentioned something a couple moments ago about changes in IRAs. It's in Congress right now. Congress seems to be for it. It's supposed to be helpful to us. It hasn't come out of Congress yet. They're a little distracted by some other things that are going on in the nation's capital. But what is it? It's really called the Secure Act.
Right, Murray. The Secure Act is probably the biggest change to IRAs since the Roth IRA. And it's got basically 27 provisions, 26 of which are great. So if you've got a small business, you can now let people be in your 401k plan. If you've got a small business, you can band together with other small businesses and have a 401k plan. If you're a long-term part-time employee, you can participate in a 401k plan. It's allowing Americans to save more money for retirement. That's a great idea. If you've got a 401k plan and you want to have a fixed income stream, you can now buy an annuity through your 401k plan. Again, good for people who want safety. One good thing I really like is the required minimum distribution now goes to age 72, which means you don't have to start taking money out of your IRA until 72. By the way, Murray, last week, the IRS had gave us really good news. They think we're going to live longer. So they actually reduced our, I wrote that in my Forbes column, they reduced the age requirement for taking a required minimum distribution. However, as I like to say, the big print gives and the fine print takes away. There's one awful thing in the Secure Act. The Secure Act says if you leave money to your kids, they have to pay taxes now over 10 years. So the rule today, right now, before Secure, is that if you left money to a 25-year-old granddaughter, she could take it out over 58.3 years. Well, think about the taxes of spreading an IRA distribution over 58 years. It's going to be low cost. Now your kids have to take all the money out over 10 years. So myself and everyone else who's a good financial advisor would tell you, hey, save up enough money. You've always got to be prepared for the future. Save and save and save. So if you've been saving and saving and saving and you've got $500,000 in your 401k plan and you don't touch it until 72, it might be $1 million. And it might be $1.5 million by the time you pass. And when you pass, your kids will have to pay tax now over 10 years. So all of us in the room should recognize something very important. In the old days, all of us would have said, put money in your 401k plan at a high tax rate and take it out later when you're retired at a low tax rate. Bad news for us and good news for us. On December 31st, 2025, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act expires. All the people in this room will probably be in a higher tax bracket. And if you're a small business owner and you're making $310,000 a year, you go from a 19% bracket to a 33% bracket. The second thing you have to pay attention to is when you start taking money out of your IRA, it's based on your life expectancy. Good news, if you live, you still got a life expectancy. And your life expectancy, however, gets smaller, so the amount of your required minimum distribution gets bigger. Third thing, if you're married to somebody you like, beloved will probably be single or you'll be single some point in time. So my wife and I, if I leave her my IRA, she'll be single in a higher tax bracket. And now Congress has tossed in Secure. Now your kids will have to pay tax over 10 years. It means a lot of things, Murray. It means that we're going to have to change our estate plans. It means most of us are going to start looking at Roth IRAs. And if you've got kids, maybe you want to set up a Roth IRA for them. If you've got kids working, they might want to do a Roth 401k. Because Roths grow tax-free, and if the kids defer that for 10 years tax-free, that's better. The second thing we're going to have to look at is how we change our estate plans. What are we going to do in terms of that? So there's an awful lot going on with Secure. It passed the House. Now listen, think closely. Does anyone agree with me that the Senate and the House seem to be slightly divided? Okay. So how about this? 417-3 out of the House. That's how it passed. And McConnell has it what's called hotline, which means he's trying to get a unanimous consent. He's got only three senators. Three senators are against it. 97-3 in the Senate. So be prepared that this will probably pass this year. I've been talking to people on Finance Committee. I've been talking to Ways and Means. Everyone tells me that it is going to pass somewhere down the line. McConnell's a little busy right now. Nancy Pelosi's a little busy right now. Everybody's got a couple other things on their mind, but this will change the way we do our plans. It will change the way you do IRAs, and it will change the way you and your kids save for the future. I'm now saving in Roth. I'm now using Roth strategies, and there's at least five different ways you can get Roths, including something called a mega Roth, where you can put $37,000 a year into a Roth. So there's lots out there. Just it's time you're going to have to switch. Hindsight's 2020. You're going to have a little bit of foresight. Your planning will change.
You can put $37,000 into a Roth tax-free?
Yep. Let's say you work at Ford. If you're a salary employee at Ford, you can make an after-tax contribution to your SSIP. You put money in there already, so you can put up to $25,000 in. Ford puts some money in because they match it. And you got about $27,000 left in what's called after-tax contributions. Ford, this year, didn't bother to tell anybody, but they added what's called a Roth in-house Roth conversion. So you can do an in-plan Roth conversion. That means a Ford salaried employee can make a $25,000 contribution, have Ford make a matching contribution, put another $27,000 in and turn it into a Roth.
Wow.
Now, how would you like to save $27,000 a year and never pay tax on it? And leave it to your kids and they don't have to pay tax on it for 10 years. There's a way to save.
Recent study by the Vanguard Mutual Fund Group found that typical 65-year-old plus has under $200,000 in their retirement account right now, which is one of the reasons that Congress decided that they had to do something to help protect people in the future and make it easier for small companies to be able to support their workers in some kind of a retirement plan like a 401k or an IRA or something like that. So part of SECURE enables small companies to better afford to present their workers with a retirement package, with a retirement plan.
For the person with $200,000, SECURE is not going to affect them that much. Leaving, you know, my mother-in-law just passed. She had a $100,000 IRA, left it to eight kids. $12,000. Who cares? It's not. They're going to get $12,000. It's not going to change their lives. So SECURE has identified the folks you're talking about. It helps those folks. It harms those of us who have larger IRAs. There's where the harm falls in place.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a harm to anybody with a bigger IRA, a bigger 401k. And Murray, the important thing is, it isn't just IRAs. If you have a 401k, or if you work at the university here, you have a 403b, or if you have a defined benefit plan with a lump sum like Ford does, or AT&T, or General Motors, those all come into play. And the advent is now for 401k plans. If you look at the UAW contract, they're offering early buyout offers to a whole bunch of people. Why? Because they want them out of the defined benefit plan and into the 401k plan. So SECURE is good. It will help a whole bunch of people. It's good for the country. It's bad for some of us.
All right, so we're talking about people who have saved and have some kind of retirement plan, but a lot of people can't even do that, Charles, because they have an emotional spending issue.
Well, sure, and even when he was talking, I was thinking, I read that only 14% of Americans contribute to an IRA, and most of that's for rollovers. So obviously, they don't have a lot of extra disposable income to even fund IRAs and that. So, and a lot of it, like you said, lifestyle expectations take shape early in life. When those are anchored too high, people tend to want to spend, and they set up a lifestyle they've grown accustomed to, what they were raised like, their parents, the way they lived, where they lived, what kind of cars they drove. That's typically what people adopt as they grow older, but then they find out that they rented their lifestyle. How do you know if you rent your lifestyle or you own your lifestyle? Well, it's going to show up in the end if you're out of money. You're going to look back in your 30s, your 40s, and 50s and say, I shouldn't have been living in that house. I shouldn't have been driving those kind of cars because now I don't have enough money. Instead of, you know, I'm in my Honda Accord, now on a bicycle, okay, basically because people have been renting lifestyle. So, but what's easier to
renting
say,
lifestyles.
Right. What's easier to say you own a $12,000 a month cash flow requirement in a lifestyle or one that's four? You know, which one's more easily say you can claim to own? Probably the lower lifestyle, lower cash flow requirement. So I always tell people, position yourself to always be able to afford to make less money. You know, I always tell people, be ready for the pink slip when the pink slip comes in. If you're living well below your income and the pink slip comes, you can go on ahead and say, you know what? I can go on ahead and take a lower paying job. Okay, why? Because I work defense. There's offensive money management, there's defensive money management. Offense, we've been inundated with information about that the past 40 years. Ask the boss for a higher paying job, give the market a dollar, have maybe 20, spend a lot of money in education with the hopes of greater return on our investment. That's all offensive thinking. Our grandparents focused on defense. Do I need it? Where can I cut? They went so far as to reuse a tea bag. Okay, that's all defense. And so much of the information out there, you go to these dinners where people will, you know, give you dinners for their investment. They want your money. They want to invest your money. But they've dropped the ball when it comes to defensive money management. It needs to be holistic. You need to be doing your part, not beating up your financial advisor, please make me double-digit returns, because I haven't done my job. I'm living in a, you know, 6,000-square-foot house, and that's all decisions we're making. Okay, so we got to pull in that, you know, make those adjustments as well so that we can have a retirement plan that's going to actually work.
How many people remember parents or grandparents using the tea bag two or three times? Yep. Look at that. How many people do that today? Nobody does. Leon does. Okay, so a couple people do it. There you go. 78% of full-time workers live paycheck to paycheck, and one out of four six-figure households are living paycheck to paycheck because they can't make ends meet. Wow. When that happens, sometimes people will help themselves to things that they shouldn't be helping themselves with. And many times when job applicants are looked at, sometimes they're looked at, their credit scores are looked at. Sometimes their credit reports are pulled. You have to know that that's going to happen if you're applying for a job. They have to tell you that. And if they disqualify you for that, they have to give you time to make it right, to make sure there are no mistakes in that credit report or with your credit score. But that brings up what Sheila deals with all the time, and that's employees who are helping themselves. And when you go into companies and ask them what they're doing to try to detect fraud, what do they tell you? Do they still tell you what they did a couple years ago when we spoke? I don't know.
They're telling me they don't have time. So when you think about a small business, a lot of times it's a mom and pop shop, there's a one-man show, one-woman show, they're doing everything, and then usually they have a bookkeeper, or they just send everything over to their CPA every month. They don't look at their accounts online, they're not looking at their transactions. And so we talk about ways to mitigate internal fraud as well as external fraud. We're talking about creating policies and procedures for your staff. Even if you're a one-man show, you need to audit what your staff is doing, what your bookkeeper is doing. We've seen examples where the bookkeeper was editing or changing QuickBooks entries. So she was making checks out to herself, but in QuickBooks, she was making it out to a vendor. So if he did go in to audit, that's what he would see. But he found out she stole about $350,000 over 2 years. Well, she was on drugs. There was no way to get it back. He decided not to press charges because she had a young child. But we see cases like this every day. My thing is, you have to make the time. You invested your money, your time, your energy, your life into building this company. You have to invest the time to make sure that you are protecting it.
$350,000. So that went on for a long time. I've seen statistics, and you probably know them better than I do, that some of these things last close to a year or longer. Some of these frauds.
Most of them are over a year. I want to say on average, they can go 5 to 7 years without being detected. If there is no type of checks and balances in place, you have to go in. And one thing I'll say is never let your bookkeeper just have complete access to your online banking. You should have a separate login ID for your bookkeeper, for your assistant, whoever's doing those things for you. And I'll tell you why. So there was an elderly couple. They trusted a young lady to manage their finances for the business for them. Well, she was managing hers as well with their money. She did everything. She said, hey, I need to get into online. I need to pay these bills online. I need to be able to, you know, pay the credit card and things like that. Well, of course, she was paying for her own extravagant trips, her vacations, her kids' birthday parties, all of those things. And they all went undetected for years until she went on a vacation. The owner's wife went to check the mail and she saw these different bills. And that's when she started to get concerned and started asking questions. Fast forward, you know, they went to the bank and said, hey, this is fraud. How do we recoup these funds? Well, the bank's investigation saw that they gave this young lady their online banking password. So how does the bank know that they didn't give her permission to make those transactions, to pay those bills, because she was still paying the business's bills, but she was paying hers too. So there was no way for them to recoup that loss, and they had to take it to court.
Wow. Questions for anybody up here? Any questions, comments? Yes, we have one right over there. Thanks.
Still figuring out the full impact of the tax reform laws of a couple of years ago. Is there anything that we should be considering with payroll deductions? Because I hear that it may be still uncertain with the, you know, what that tax reform is going to look like in the next couple of years.
I'll grab that one because I'm a CPA. The Tax Reform Act did cut taxes, but then in a weird thing that I'm a little suspect of, they changed the withholding tables incorrectly, and a lot of people got a rude awakening. The idea was they wanted everybody to have more money in their paycheck, and the payroll table did not reflect whether your spouse worked or whether you had a business or you had anything else. So now that you've got some water under the bridge and you know what your 2018 tax return looks like, it's very important that you have withheld basically what you paid last year. That's the most important part. So if you're going forward and looking what you ought to do with your paycheck and your withholdings, withhold what you had last year, and that's generally a safe harbor. If you're a real big dog and you're making big money, do a little bit more. So do more. But the safe place to be is pay what you paid last year. Worst case scenario, you get a little refund, big deal. Better to have a refund than to pay a penalty. So that's what I would do.
Can we be sure that taxes are going to go up? I mean, is that we've had tax reform, we've been told taxes are coming come down, but aren't we at the end of that, and what happens after that, and what should we be thinking about?
Well, in my role as the director of the Michigan Association of CPAs, I actually lobbied on the last tax law bill. And so there's a new one. There is a new one going through for next year. They want to cut taxes again. I give it a chance, probably the same chance as impeachment, zero. So it's not going to pass, and I don't think the tax bill will pass. We could have a new president next year. In 6 years, we'll have a new president. Who knows where that will be? Everybody should think about probably the big problem. No one wants to look at the 1,000-pound gorilla in the room. We're running a $1 trillion deficit. $1 trillion. For fun, write that on a piece of paper. For more fun, you know, take 3% of that and look what the interest on $1 trillion is. How do you get rid of a $1 trillion deficit? By cutting your revenue source. Wouldn't that be, it'd be like Charles and I going, Charles helping me with my finances, and my wife and Ann and I saying, well, you know, Charles, you know, we're spending $10,000 more a year than we make, so what do you think we should do? And he says, I think you should make less. I mean, that's the craziest thing I've ever heard. So if we're looking at that kind of thing, Murray, I would say the odds are in the future we won't have more tax cuts. We have a political will to do it, but it's just going to bankrupt us. It's just, you know, how would all of you live if I cut your revenue? Yeah, we're at $22 trillion of debt. We're at $1 trillion a year of overspending.
35% more than a year ago, I think it was.
Yes.
Right?
And in the old days, it used to be there were people like me who were called deficit hawks who said, quit spending more money than you make. Cut it out. I mean, wouldn't we tell that to everybody we know? Quit spending more money than you make. And the government's spending more money than it makes and wants to spend more than more money than it makes.
So if we know taxes are going to go up, or we really believe that, is there something we should be doing in the next year and a half, while taxes are low?
Well,
relatively low.
I'm looking at Secure, which actually is a $15 billion tax increase. A Roth IRA, for now, is tax-free. Okay, so there's a way to save more money tax-free. Doing what Charles said, making sure your budget is associated correctly, is a really good idea, so you're not hit with that extra thing. We talked about risks in the beginning. How many of you would say that a risk would be higher taxes? And how many of you think that's possible? So if you plan that you're going to pay more taxes in the future and you don't, the worst thing that happens to you is you have more money. That's an okay outcome. If you sit there and live hand to mouth, or you live like the government and spend 10% more than you make, then it's bad when taxes increase. Now you're sitting there borrowing money on your Visa to pay your income tax bill, which is probably the worst use of a Visa I can think of, at least the vacation you can enjoy. So I would say we are going to see tax increases in the future. If we get President Warren or President Sanders, probably a lot sooner than we thought. If we end up just with President Trump again, probably we'll still have the status quo and it'll stay that way until 2025. But as a tax attorney and a CPA, I tell my clients, look, we plan for right now, but we take an identification of what might happen. And we always identify the bad thing that'll happen and plan for that. And if it doesn't, that's a good outcome. Plan for the worst, hope for the best.
All right, and Charles, 45% of credit card holders say they're having trouble paying their bills right now, but they're still going to go out and spend more this holiday season because it's the holidays and we really need to spend more and we deserve to spend more. That's what they're saying. These are people who will probably be in your seminars next year because they have some problems. How do you curb that? How do you look ahead and say, what should I be doing right now before the holidays come? It's a mind process. Financial advisors and financial educators, not only money manager people, but they're also mind management people, too.
Well, it goes back to the fact that they look at that stuff as unexpected expense, believe it or not. I mean, they do. They do. They don't anticipate it. When I sit down with people and do a budget, I say, January, how many birthdays? February, March. Mother's Day, Father's Day, baby showers, wedding showers, anniversaries, Christmas. Add it all up. Divide by what? 12. There's 12 months in a year. The expenditures don't all happen in one month. They're spread out through the year. One month it's a boatload, like the holidays, like Christmas, and other months there's nothing. Well, how do you regulate that within a budget? Well, you add up the total, divide by 12. That should be deducted right off the top off your income. And I didn't reinvent the wheel. Transfer that money automatically into an envelope, electronic envelope, a savings account that I call a gift account. Okay. That's what I do when I do develop people's budgets. Y'all have a checking account? Yeah, I have a checking account. What do you do with it? Everything. Well, that's your problem right there. Why are you using one checking account for everything? You don't know in the stream of a month where you're at financially. I can't stand it when people tell me the first pay of the month I pay these bills, second pay of the month I pay these bills. It shouldn't matter when the creditor comes and takes the money that belongs to them. The problem is that you're using one checking account for everything. Your spending money should be in a different account. So I established what's called a bill account. Everything's automated. Ebbs and flows, it doesn't matter. It can be your car insurance. You want to pay it once a year or twice a year, so that's less money. Well, that money rises, and then they come take their money. You're not touching that money for anything other than bills. Now, where's my money? Well, you have money transferred to another checking account. First and the 15th of the month, your job is to get to the 15th, you get another cash infusion, 15th to the 30th. That's how you live. What creates debt? That budget's not complete. A budget should only have two parts, present and future. Present and future. Present and future. Present expenses and saving for future anticipated expenses. That is a budget, okay? When people come see me, they have a third part of their budget, debt. That's called the past. What'd you buy with that? I couldn't tell you. It's 50 grand in credit card debt. I don't know where it came from. I don't know what it is. They have past, present, and future, and they have to deal with now. Because they didn't handle the future, they now have a past. Instead of handling the future, if you got out of school, don't have debt, college, you don't have a debt, parents paid your way through school, whatever the case may be, you have the opportunity to never create debt. And debt is very expensive because you got to service the debt. The debt's very costly. People make less money today than they did years ago. You know, financial reversals, people don't recover as quickly today as they did years ago. And, you know, the more you make, the more you spend. Lifestyle inflation, you know, just we talk about taxes. You know, people have all absorbed that decrease in their taxes, and they're using that money now, okay? They didn't, you know, just like even Social Security, I tell people, you shouldn't be living on both checks. You should be living on the higher check. The other check should be put away, because what's eventually going to happen? One of you is going to go. One of you is going to die, and the other spouse is going to be left with one check. Have you budgeted for one check? You should be developing a budget that only anticipates the higher earning check. The other check should not be, our lifestyle shouldn't be dependent on the other check. Just put that away for medical or something.
You talk about subsidizing debt, past, present, and future, and subsidizing debt. As we speak here today, 35 million people are still paying last year's holiday bills. They're still paying off that debt. We have a question right up here in the front.
I almost forgot. It's in reference to the gentleman.
Thank you for waiting so patiently.
Yeah. I'm like, you know, wait a minute, I'm not 25 anymore. But anyway, concerning, you talked about the national debt. It's like over $16 trillion. And you mentioned about the upcoming presidential election, and you named some of the candidates. No, I don't want to see Trump come back in. We're having an inequality going on in this country where the 1% is not paying their share of taxes. It's a burden shift on people. people across the country that's making far more or less than these people making, that's millionaires and billionaires. We can't continue this and have the people survive. You know, and we're going to get more in debt, more stress, more illnesses because of what's going on in Washington, D.C., where we don't have a situation where Congress can't seem to come together for the people who voted for them.
It's very important to go to the polls, to research the candidates, to know their positions and everything that's going to affect everything in our lives, especially when it comes to money, rather than cast opinions or dispersions on certain candidates. We're in this together. Everybody's in this together, and we have to figure out a way out of it. We have to look at the national debt. We have to look at our household debt. We have to look at what happens in our businesses, and we have to go from there. And we have to also take a look at what we have and deal with what we have right now.
Hey, Murray, and great point. I just did an interview with Investment News on the different candidates' wealth taxes and their proposals. And so I think we ought to all look at those from a different standpoint. First and foremost, there's an idea that we want to go tax people who have a lot of money. And by the way, we should be allowed to be a billionaire. I don't think there's anything wrong with becoming a billionaire. But I also think that you should pay your fair share, and that's part of it. So we have property taxes. If I own a house in West Bloomfield, I pay more property taxes than if I have a house in Oak Park. So there's nothing wrong with taxing the value of somebody's assets. I don't think there's a problem with that. An issue I think we ought to all be thinking about is this. Think about student loan debt, and think about the fact that the student loan debt is a burden to all the young people out there. We're talking about $1.6 trillion of student loan debt. And what's that making all those people who have student loan debt do? They're not buying cars. They're not buying houses. They're not able to start businesses because they're saddled with this debt that they can't get out of. And you probably see it all the time, Charles. So what is that debt actually worth? And what would happen if we said to the people who have student loan debt, instead of us doing all the rest of this stuff, we're going to have a reverse tax. We're going to forgive your student loan debt. And if you already paid it off, we're going to give you a tax credit. And what do you think would happen to those millions of people who have student loan debt and went that way? So there are parts of the proposals of the different candidates that do make some sense, and there's something that might really enhance our economy. And that would be taking all the young people and helping them go become consumers and helping them go buy houses and helping them being able to have a budget with Charles' advice and get rid of the past to go to the future. So there's a lot of ways to look at this. I don't think we ever want to stop people in America from making money. I don't think we ever want to do that. I grew up a poor kid in Hazel Park, born in Detroit, managed to grow a successful business, merged my business up, and I got there because I live in a great free country. My dad got to go to Lawrence Tech and serve in World War II. They taught me the hard way. Use your tea bags over again, save your money, get out there and work your butt off. And it's amazing what happens if you work your butt off, how lucky you get. But at the same time, I don't think we want to have this disparity. And you're correct in the fact that the disparity is worse than it ever was. I would hope we could start with getting rid of that disparity on some of the young people who are saddled with this burden of the past. So there's just something in the campaigns to look at as well.
We have a question over here before you forget.
Yeah, before I forget, I wrote it down. I don't know how many other people here are retiree like myself, but what do the panel see as our greatest challenges for retirees going forward into 2020 and beyond?
One of the biggest things is still have, a lot of them have mortgages. 49.8% of spending for those over the age of 65 is housing and transportation.
Well,
half the financial pie.
So.
Yeah. Where our grandparents' day, how many homes they have in a lifetime? One. How many mortgages they have? One. One mortgage, they paid it off, right? And during the housing boom, everybody's moving every 7 to 9 years. Every time you move, you got to make a house a home, right? Cha-ching. Costs money. I always tell, like Murray, I was telling Murray earlier, you know, when people, we see it at the credit union, people are retired or near retirement and they're refinancing 30-year mortgages. They're pulling, and they can't come up with a closing cost, okay? Because they've been on the American budget and they keep using their home as a piggy bank and they keep shifting debt and they think that's solving their problem. So cash flow requirements need to fall as you age. As you get older, cash flow requirements need to be falling, and they're not. And one of the biggest things is housing. You know, when people live in a house, they take out a 30-year mortgage, they're in that house for, you know, 8 years and they move. I typically tell them, always take a 30-year mortgage just in case of a job loss. You can drop in a lower payment, but you don't pay it that way. If you were in your prior house for 8 years, the next house should be paid off in 22 years. You've already been paying on a house for 8 years. That if you can't amortize and pay the next payment on the next house for 22 years, you are overbuying. You can't afford this move, okay? You move again. Subtract the years in that house. Amortize that. But always take a 30-year mortgage out because job losses happen. And you want to be able to drop into that lower payment if that is the case. But for folks that are older that don't have their homes paid off, what I typically say, when you're in your 50s and that, throw as much money as you can against your house. And hopefully interest rates will cooperate. They probably will because everything's going to be kept. Rates are going to be kept down maybe. I'm not a, you know, whatever. But hopefully that happens in refinance. Just before you retire and throw it out 30 years. What did you just do? Your $1,900 house payment that you have, and you threw all that extra equity in, you can refinance, drop the payment down, because now it's not an option to pay it off. Now it's all about cash flow. You got to drop the cash flow in retirement. So you it's too late, because I have folks, they'll tell me, oh yeah, I see the wisdom. My grandparents paid their homes off. They positioned themselves to be able to afford to make less money. Brilliant, you know, 10th grade education, but they just were practically wise, right? They knew when I get older, I can't dig ditches, I can't work, my knees hurt, I got to be able to afford to make less money. Okay, so they just had practical wisdom. One of the biggest things is housing. Housing is a huge challenge for people. The average Social Security check is like $1,400. People are trying to pay, you know, their Medicare out of that, their home. They get, you know, eventually they're going to end on one check and no savings. The three-legged support for retirement, pension, gone the way of the dinosaur. Savings, abysmal. Third is a Social Security check, and that's what folks are doing. You know,
and that's a big question mark for the future.
69% of Americans are retiring by the age of 65, and I'm like, why? 69% Americans retiring by the age of 65? It's crazy. Okay, to what? To a house payment?
You had another question?
So, yeah. Can I, Murray, can I pop
in? Yeah, and then we have one over here, and we're going to go.
So I got a quick question for the group. Does anyone in the group think that stocks could go down? Okay. Does anybody in the room know what the interest rate in Germany is right now for a bond? It's negative 0.4%. That means you pay Germany to lend them your money. So how is it going to work in the future if I'm a retiree and I want something safe to invest in and interest rates are close to zero? In fact, the president was tweeting this week that he wanted negative rates in the United States.
He said it at the New York Economic Club.
Yeah. How's that work for y'all? How's that work for y'all? By the way, anybody in the room want to pay me to lend me money? I'm in. So I'm in 100%. I see one of the big challenges is that we've got quantitative easing all around the world. We've got the Bank of Japan at negative rates. We've got the Bank of Switzerland at negative rates. We've got the EU Central Bank at negative rates. So we've got this extremely weird situation where 30% of all the government debt in the world is at negative interest rates. Negative. Now, Charles will verify this. If I have $100,000 saved up and I'm making less than zero, it's not working for me. Okay? So the answer is when you're in a negative interest rate, you take all your money, cash it in, throw it in a jar, and take a $100 bill out once a week. And that's going to be your challenge. It's going to be the challenge of this challenging rate and challenging economic environment, and it don't get no better in this short run.
Programming note here, today at 4:20, I will be talking about that very topic, negative interest rates, because it came up in conversations nationally this week. So that's 4:20 on WWJ.
Murray, I just have one thing.
That is, yes.
For businesses, business owners that are thinking about retiring, the main issue is succession planning. They don't have a plan on what to do with their business. They think their kids are going to take over the business, but the kids are like, I don't want to work like you. You work too much. I don't want to do that. So then their question is, okay, do I sell the business to a loyal employee who's been here for a long time? Do I just shut down? What do I do? And do I have enough saved to actually retire, because I've been working in this business so many years, putting all my money back into the business. Have I set aside anything? So I would say, you know, talk to your CPA, talk to your financial planner, talk to your banker, so that you can talk about estate planning, succession planning also.
Good point. Yeah, real quick, and then we're going to go around here.
Real quick, just one ancillary question. Buy versus lease on an auto for a retiree. What do you say on that?
I don't like leasing because you're always in a payment. Okay, here's my deal on the cars, okay? Americans like to always be vulnerable. Buy, pay off, buy payoff. I had a guy from Ford Motor Company come up to me. He had two expedition payments, a house payment. He lost his job. And I'm like, why are you in two car payments? He's like, looks at me like, what are you talking about? Doesn't everybody have a car payment? Like, no. How about buy, pay off, keep? Okay, now what are you doing during the time you're keeping? You've been living without the car payment, right? You've been already been living without that cash. Have that money transfer into a savings account. Use that money for car repairs and continue to drive that car, okay? Buy, pay off, keep. Now what happens, you lose your job. You can't put the money in savings anymore, right? Because you don't have the cash flow. It's okay, but no one's gonna come in your driveway and take your car. Okay, cars last longer than they ever have, but Americans are trading them in all the time. Okay, I mean, people look at a car as an extension of themselves. They're driving on the expressway, impressing people they don't even know. Right? They're never going to see them again. Okay, how many people you work with even know what you drive unless they walk out to the parking lot? But people have been indoctrinated into thinking that they are an extension of their vehicle. Okay, instead of looking at it as transportation, that's a huge expense. Okay, and so. I'm all for buying a vehicle. Okay, insurance gets cheaper as the car gets older. Just make sure you're taking care of the car. But you want to be able to have, it's all about position. If I had a credo, position yourself to be able to afford to make less money. Okay, even with students and college loans, I tell them, you walk into a job interview, you throw your credit report on the table and say, I can afford to make what you want to pay. That employer is looking at, 50% of employers are looking at credit reports. They're thinking, can this kid work for me? I want to pay $19 an hour. He's got $80,000 in student loan debt. No, next, okay? Position yourself to be able to afford to make less money. A lot of kids think, oh, don't bother trying to pay my student loans down because everybody, no one can afford to pay their way through college. I'm like, you should try, okay? At least be paying something, slow down so that you're not accumulating debt. At least pay the interest, because that affects your credit score, by the way, if you don't pay the interest on your student loan debt, which is another whole topic. I don't want to bring up other things, but.
But back to the cars. Average loan today for a new car is over $32,000. For a used car, it's over $20,000. And one out of five car buyers who finance their vehicles are paying over $50,000 in loans just to buy the vehicle, not talking about what they may have put in up front. So that's where a lot of money goes. Yes, sir.
Hello, everyone. I'm a small business owner, and I have a lot of clients who are real estate developers. And they're pretty much maxing, they're leveraging everything. And I'm a little concerned because I'm like, okay, so you're leveraging all this, you're buying all this property. At some point in time, the economy may just tank. So what advice do I give them? Because I'm kind of concerned that, okay, they're maximizing everything and eventually it may not be a client of mine because they're maxed out. And the other question is I also have clients that are single women who have lost a lot of their money because their husbands have passed away or they're just in a bad situation and they've cut everything. I mean, cable bill, they're living to almost bare minimum. What advice do you give them when they say, hey, I just don't have enough money. I've cut everything I can cut.
Can I just add something on that? I don't know what it is about Americans or North America. We all think we have the right to live alone. Okay, you look at the world, nuclear families, they're all living together, okay? Today's world, I tell people, young people especially, you got to earn the right to live alone, okay? They think it's some entitlement that I can just live alone. No, it's something you have to earn, and it's by sound money management. You got to position yourself to be able to make less money, and you got to pay off your debt, and that's just a start, okay? Even, investing and stuff. I mean, debt is a for sure. The market's always going to be a maybe. Okay. In fact, some of the guys that are investors at the credit union, they kind of make a joke. They told me this later. They kind of laughed because I always talk about paying off the house. And they're investor guys, right? So they always want to, promote putting the money in the market. I'm like, well, here's the deal. If you would have made more money in the market and you paid your house off, you're never going to know. But if you put in the market and it tanks and you owe the house, do you know that? And you tell me which one keeps you up at night. Okay? So, and they told me later that their clients, the ones in 2007 happened, the ones that had their homes paid off, weathered that storm so much better than those that owed their mortgages. They were flipping out in 2008 when it crashed. So, people have to open their mind to the fact that they're going to have to live with other people. I mean, they're going to, you know, find roommates, okay? And even students that get out of school, I say, don't move out of the house until your loans are paid off. There was a guy at the credit union had $60,000 in student loan debt. I said, hey, dude, this you gotta pay this loan off, right? So he did. He put $10,000 a year on his loans, on his principal, and 6 years got out of debt. And if you can't stand mom and dad, live with four friends, rent a house, and say, you know what, we're going to all work together and get our loans paid off, and then we're going to move our separate ways. But otherwise, you're never going to get out of debt. You're not going to reach retirement. You're not going to, because these repayments have been, the income-driven repayment plans are lower than interest. I had a guy just saw me in March. He got his MBA in 1998, had $47,000 in student loan debt. He come to see me. His loan balance is $133,000, and he didn't go to any more school. That's just interest and fees.
Really good business concept that you brought up, and we have discussed it on the air with business consultants. It's not enough to ask your clients or your customers, are you okay with my service? Are we doing everything right? How would you rate this and that? They may give you all A's. The question to ask, these consultants have said to us on the air, is everything okay? How are you doing? Because as you have spotted, if they're not doing well, it's going to come back and hit you too. And there are so many auto suppliers here that are looking at the big companies and the Fords and the GMs and the Fiat Chryslers, and they're saying, well, we have to make some changes here because we see what's happening with those people, and those are the people that we depend on. So it's not enough to ask, you happy with our service? You know, everybody that you ask a question to, they'll send you an email survey to take. Are you happy with this? The question is everything okay?
Hey, Murray,
I just want to go back to, oh, I'm sorry, yeah.
Can I pop 1 second on his real estate question? He asked the question about real estate developers overextending. I did a paper that I published on our website under recessionopportunities.com, which has got a white paper with 8 things business owners should do facing recession. So real estate people have in their blood to use leverage. And at this point in time, with money as cheap as it is, I see why they're doing it. But a recession opportunity kit, which is what we put on the web, will let you look at 8 ways that you might be able to take advantage of that. In other words, the question I ask all my real estate developers are, what are you going to do when we get a downturn? What are you going to do when the rents go down, when you lose 10% vacancy or whatever the case may be? So recessionopportunities.com, recession opportunity kit, go grab it if you want. It's a nice little document. It's got 8 things individuals should do, 8 things that businesses should do, and some other good information. There's actually a video on there too that I did with the MICPA that talks about what to do in a recession.
And to get that, how do we get that?
Just go on the web, recessionopportunities.com or Sequoia-Financial Group.
Recessionopportunities.com.
Yep, recessionopportunities.com. When Secure passes, by the way, we'll have IRAideas.com, and that'll be out too. There'll be a 27-page guide on what to do with Secure.
All right, a couple things I wanted to ask you, Sheila, before we wrap this thing up. When we're talking about businesses, we're talking about homes, we're also talking about external problems that we really need to address and look at in the new year. And we know that fraud is going to be continuing to go up because it's one industry that continues to rise every single year, whether there's a recession or not. Talk about passwords and logins, if you will, that everybody should have their own password, everybody should have their own login, whether you're in a company, whether you're in your home, whether you're in a family unit, whether you're at a school building.
Well, a couple of things. One, in regards to fraud mitigation, identity theft, security, having a strong password is very important. A couple of years ago, I sat on this panel, and there was a guy who was a professional hacker. And he said, the thing with passwords or hacking is that most of them can easily get into your accounts because you haven't changed your password, or you have something so easy like 123456789, or password, or QWERTY, which are the characters at the top of the keyboard. So you want to make sure that you have a very strong password. I I know that it's a headache when you're going there and you're trying to create those passwords, and they're like, you got to have a capital letter and a lowercase letter and a number and a character, but it helps to protect you. In regards to your bank accounts, I would say never use the same password along, if you have accounts at different banks and multiple banks, never use that same password at different sites. Change it up a little bit and set up account alerts so that you know what's going on with your accounts. At PNC, you can set up account alerts if there's a debit coming out of your account. If your balance is a certain threshold, you can set up those. So if your account does get hacked, you're getting a text, you're getting an email, you can find out right away and we can stop it and we can recover that loss.
And when we think about electronic payments and more of our bills are being paid electronically, should we still be worrying about the security issue with that, or is that almost solved? Or, Sheila, will it never be solved?
I think it's safer to pay electronically. People think that it's safer to just write a good old check. But when you write a check, you're giving out all of your information. If I called you up or tapped you on the shoulder and said, hey, can I have your account number and routing number? You would think I was crazy. You would hang up on me just like those folks that call you and say they want to help you with your loan, your student loan debt, right? But if you owe me money, you're going to write me a check. I have your account number, your routing number, your name, your address, anything that I need to compromise your account or try to take something from you. I can go online, I can pay my DTE bill with your account number and routing number that you just gave me on the bottom of your check. I can go and create other checks. There's so many different things that you can do. So we urge our clients to do more electronic payments. Paying with a credit card, if you're paying responsibly with a credit card, can protect you from debt. From fraud, instead of using your debit card. So one thing I do is I look at my account. If it's in my account, then I can spend it on my credit card, right? And I pay it off every time I get paid just to make sure that I'm not overwhelmed at the end of the month. But what I'm doing is protecting myself, because if my debit card gets hacked, my account is hacked. That money is gone. The bank has up to 90 days to do their research, their investigation, and get your money back. But who has 90 days to wait if, you know, for businesses, the average loss is $20,000. A small business, that's huge. Who has 90 days to wait for that, right? It usually doesn't take that long. But in the meantime, you have payroll, or even for your home, your mortgage payment could be coming out, right? So no one has time to wait for the bank to do that research and get those funds back in your account. Where if you have fraud on your credit card, you might have to call and wait on the phone for a little while, and you might have to wait 7 to 10 business days to get a new card, but your account is still safe, because all of those cards, Visa, MasterCard, Discover, American Express, they have some type of fraud protection to protect you. And the main thing is that you also get points or some type of rewards for making those payments too.
Just remember how many rewards you have so you can spend the rewards.
I'm trying to go to Tahiti, so I buy everything on my card.
There you go. Anybody else have a question? Yes, we have one in the back right there. Microphone on the way.
Thank you. Good morning. So we have two people on your panel that work for either Dearborn Credit Union or PNC Bank. So they rely on their income being the interest that we're paying on those accounts. And so my question is it possible to go to your financial institutions and negotiate lower percentage rates on your debt? Because I get calls from my bank saying, you know, it's time to refinance your house even though I don't have a mortgage. And they offer me a low rate. At the same time, they're sending me a credit card offer at a very high rate. So I wanted to just get your comments on that.
You can negotiate almost anything. And, of course, when push comes to shove and you have an issue, and you're facing a financial problem, if you call your creditors, you call your banks, you call your credit card companies, maybe they'll work with you because they would rather do that and have you eventually pay it off with better terms than settle for 20 cents on the dollar if you have to go into bankruptcy court or less.
Everything's based on credit score today. It's all risk-based lending based on credit scores. If we were to make exceptions, then there's openings for auditors, you know, to come in and say, why did you favor this one person over another person? But DFCU, you know, we return since 2006, we pay cash back $300 million back to our members based on a half percentage of the relationship. So if you had a $200,000 mortgage with DFCU in January, they'll deposit $1,000 into your savings account. okay? So we've been doing that since 2006. So we give back to the members because the credit union's a well-run institution, but it's based on the relationship. So they add up an aggregate amount of your loans, your savings, and the whole nine yards, and then 0.5% of that is deposited every year into your savings account. That's how DFCU compensates individuals. But as far as negotiation, no, it's all based on risk-based lending. That started back in the early days in 93, 94. I remember when they brought that in. It first started with mortgages, and then it went into consumer loans, and now they're sophisticated enough to do with credit cards. You know what I mean? You can get different interest rates based on credit scores with a financial institution. It's all, you know, changed the industry.
So what I just said before, if you have a problem and you need help, and you call, they will not help?
Oh, yeah. Well, the credit union, you're talking now the collection department. If you're having difficulty, they'll work with you and things like that. Sure, a lot of the credit card companies will do that, you know. If it depends on, you know, the nature of the problem.
Okay.
Okay, so a quick follow-up question, though. So if I have multiple credit cards, and I always am changing to find the lowest credit card rate that I can, is that going to increase my credit score or decrease my credit score?
It doesn't hurt your score to do that, especially if you've been a consumer of the managing credit for as long as you have, like because you're an older gentleman. That's not going to hurt you, okay? The biggest thing, you want to keep your credit utilization under 10% for it to not take any points off your score. You'll hear people tell you 30%, you can use 30% of your line, but if you don't want to affect your score at all, it has to be under 10% utilization, okay? You can open up credit cards, but you know, every scoring system's different. Experian has a scoring system called a Plus Score. They'll tell you to close out credit cards you're not using. Yes, it does raise that score, but it doesn't raise the score lenders are using, which is FICO, because your utilization rate, you know, cards that have been managed for more than 10 years start to add considerable points to your credit score. You start getting additional points after you've had a credit card for 7 years. Okay, so I always tell younger people, go on ahead and establish those relationships with your prime lenders, like, you know, Chase, Visa, you know, credit unions, things like that. And department store cards, you want to wean yourself off of those.
PNC.
Oh, yeah, PNC.
PNC. Oh, yeah, PNC. I would say be strategic if you're a business owner, okay? Even if you're a homeowner, be strategic in the way you utilize your credit cards and lines of credit. So, like, if you're a business owner, if you're purchasing something, the first thing you want to do is purchase it on your credit card. I know you're like, why would I buy that on my credit card? But you get 30 days interest-free. Right? If you can't pay it off at the end of the month, and all businesses should have some type of line of credit, you pay it off with your line of credit. That way, now you're paying a single-digit interest rate for your line of credit if you have pretty good credit, right? Instead of double digits, really high double digits on credit cards, you're getting rewards, you're getting that 30 days interest, and you're pushing those payables back. So just be strategic. Even if you have like a home equity and you see that you're getting really high and you're trying to lower that rate, home equity rates are super low. So if you can be very strategic with that, I would just say don't run that credit card debt back up. Make sure you pay it down.
Thank you all for being here, giving us some advice as we look ahead to a new year. We hope that everybody has a great new year. And in the new year, we have a lot of great programs scheduled here for our Leaders and Innovators series at Lawrence Technological University. Check our website. We will be updating it over the next month with all of the good things that we're working on for next year and next semester. It's WWJNewsRadio.com. Thank you for being here. Drive carefully in this bad weather, and of course, every 10 minutes on the 8s. We'll tell you how the traffic and weather is together. Thank you all for being here. We appreciate your time. Thanks.
Thank you.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of 4 amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get 4 iPhone 15s on us and 4 lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.